From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We who say we believe in this other world need to know that we are not losers. We did not lose the battle of ideas. We were not outsmarted, and we were not out-argued. We lost because we were crushed. Sometimes we were crushed by army tanks, and sometimes we were crushed by think tanks. And by think tanks, I mean the people who are paid to think by the makers of tanks.
Journalist and author Naomi Klein. Her forthcoming book is The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Today we hear her speech on Lost Worlds. But first, a bullet pierces the studio window of Pacifica radio station KPFT. It's not the first time the Houston station has been targeted. It's the only radio station in the country whose transmitter was blown up twice, shortly after it went on the air in 1970 by the Ku Klux Klan. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More than 200 people are dead and 300 injured after four suicide bombings struck a Kurdish sect community in northern Iraq. It was one of the deadliest attacks in the 4 years since the U.S.-led invasion. The Yazidi sect has been seen escalating tensions with militant Islamic groups. The casualty toll is expected to rise as rescue workers dig through the rubble. Meanwhile, the Pentagon announced the deaths of 9 U.S. troops. 5 died in a helicopter crash. The violence comes as U.S. forces have launched new crackdowns across Iraq. More than 16,000 U.S. and Iraqi troops are taking part in Operation Lightning Hammer around Diyala River. In Baghdad, at least 2 people were killed in a U.S.-led raid on the Shiite neighborhood of Sadr City. The victims were reported to be a father and his 3-year-old daughter asleep in the summer heat on the roof of their home. 9 others were arrested, including the 3 sons of local resident Fala.
I used to bake bread and sell it to feed them, and when they grew up, they started working and helping me. We thought that we would be relieved when Saddam fell. We didn't expect him to be replaced with something worse. Only God can beat the Americans.
In other Iraq developments, new figures show the number of prisoners inside Iraq continues to rise. According to the Pentagon, there are now more than 23,000 people in U.S.-run jails inside Iraq. That's 5,000 more over 4 months ago and an all-time high since the U.S.-led invasion of March 2003. The Bush administration has announced it will add Iran's Revolutionary Guard to its list of foreign terrorist groups. The move would mark the first time a wing of a foreign government's forces would be added to the list. Administration officials are calling the move a reaction to Iran's alleged involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq. The news comes on the heels of Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's visit to Afghanistan Tuesday for a meeting with Afghan President Hamid Karzai. Speaking alongside Karzai in Kabul, Ahmadinejad denied U.S. accusations of armoring Taliban insurgents.
Our policy is clear, and as we have already announced, we strongly support the political process in Afghanistan. The security in Afghanistan has a primary impact on Iran because we have the largest joint border. A strong and stable Afghanistan is best for Iran. We want our best friend to be powerful, developed, and stable.
Hundreds of thousands of people gathered in Beirut Tuesday to mark the 1-year anniversary of the end of Israel's attack on Lebanon. In a videotaped message, Hezbollah leader Syed Nasrallah warned Israel against another war and praised what he called Hezbollah's military victory over the invading troops.
The resistance revived the Arab nations and renewed hope, trust, and enthusiasm for the people in the Muslim and the Arab world. Because the resistance offered a real alternative for liberating lands instead of humiliating negotiations where America and Israel imposed their conditions. That is why they want to isolate and pressure it.
More than 1,000 Lebanese, mostly civilians, died in the 34-day conflict. 43 Israeli civilians were killed in Hezbollah rocket attacks on Israeli towns. Federal treatment of detained undocumented workers is under new scrutiny following three deaths in U.S. immigration jails over the past month. 23-year-old Victoria Arellano died after her AIDS treatment lapsed at a California immigration jail. Fellow prisoners cared for her before she was moved to a hospital. She died shackled to her bed. Another victim, Edmar Alves Araujo, died after immigration officials ignored his relatives' pleas to provide medicine for his epilepsy. The third victim, Rosa Isela Contreras Dominguez, died in an El Paso immigration jail while 7 weeks pregnant. A new study shows only half of Americans eligible for food stamps have actually received them on a regular basis. According to the National Priorities Project, more than 49%, 17 million people who are eligible poor have not gotten entitled food stamps. The former head of the American Psychological Association has been revealed to be a minority partner in a private firm linked to the CIA's controversial detention and interrogation of prisoners overseas. Joseph Dominique Matarazzo has admitted he has a board seat and a 1% ownership in the company Mitchell Jessen and Associates. Mitchell Jessen has been hired for classified interrogation consulting work with the CIA. The disclosure comes just ahead of the APA's national conference this weekend in San Francisco. Dissident members are leading calls to reverse the American Psychological Association's policy of condoning member involvement in the interrogation of U.S. prisoners. We'll bring you a special on that subject on Friday and Monday in San Francisco. In media news, the radio talk show host Don Imus has reached an undisclosed settlement over his firing from CBS. Imus was forced out earlier this year after referring to the Rutgers women's basketball team as, quote, nappy-headed hoes. Imus had threatened to seek more than $120 million for breach of contract. He's been rumored to have actually received some $20 million. Some observers say the settlement could mark a step towards Imus's return to the airwaves. He's said to be in talks with the radio station WABC about resuming his daily broadcast. News of the settlement came as Rutgers women's basketball team member Kia Vaughn filed suit against Imus for slander and libel. Vaughn says Imus's sexist and racist comments damaged her reputation. New documents point to more Bush administration censorship on global warming. The Government Accountability Project has made public memos showing the administration routinely interfered with the World Bank's limited efforts to address environmental issues. In one case, then World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz personally intervened to remove the words climate change from the title of a bank report. Wolfowitz also ordered staffers to shift the focus of the text away from global warming. And finally, a new poetry book has been released with some unlikely contributors. Poems from Guantanamo, The Detainees Speak, is a volume of poems written by prisoners at the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay. Guantanamo attorney and Northern Illinois Law School professor Mark Falkoff helped compile the book.
The book is meant to humanize the men, and it's meant to really provoke discussion in the U.S. about what Guantanamo is, what it's become, what it means for us as a country to keep this lawless zone active.
The book is 84 pages long. Military censors barred thousands of lines of poetry from being released. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A drive-by shooting targeted Pacifica radio station KPFT in Houston early Monday morning. A single bullet blasted through a plexiglass window into the station studio at 1 a.m. No one was injured in the shooting, but the bullet came within 18 inches of Mary Thomas. She was hosting a Zydeco music program at the time. KPFT station manager Dwayne Bradley said the shooting might have been political. If so, it would not be the first politically motivated attack on KPFT. More than 35 years ago, the Ku Klux Klan blew up the station's transmitters twice within the Houston station's first year of operation. In October of 1970, 5 months after the first bombing, KPFT's transmitter was bombed for a second time, just as the station was broadcasting folk legend Arlo Guthrie's song Alice's Restaurant. This is a clip of a recreation of that moment.
I want wanted to feel like the all-American kid. I walked in, I was hung down, brung down, swung down, hung up. I walked in and sat down and gave me a piece of paper, said, kid. See the psychiatrist, room 604. I walked up there, I said, shrink, I want to kill. I mean, I want to.
Well, when I first heard that Pacifica had been bombed off the air, it was like shock. I couldn't imagine that anybody would want to really, you know, do something like that.
It was a very professional job. They knew what to do. They knew where to find you. And they did it.
An excerpt of recreation of what happened in 1970 when KPFT first went on the air. The only radio station in the country to be blown up, in fact, blown up twice by the Klan. Well, we're now joined from Houston, Texas, by KPFT station manager Dwayne Bradley. We're also joined by Mary Thomas. She's the host of the weekly Zydeco music program on KPFT. The bullet that was fired into the station Monday morning narrowly missed her head. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Mary, let's begin with you. Explain exactly what was happening. It was 1 o'clock on Monday morning?
Yes.
And where were you in the station?
I was at the board doing the music.
And then what happened?
And, I could see somebody from the inside camera knocking on the door. So John R., the person that was helping me, he went to the door to see who it was. And I told him, I said, if you don't know who it is, don't let him in. But anyway, when he got to the door, he found out that it was somebody that we knew that comes to the station. And while he was doing this, then a big boom came through the window right where I had just moved my chair from that window. And I fell to the floor because I turned my head right quick, but then I saw the big hole, and I just fell to the floor and crawled into the next room, and made a phone call to 911. Mm.
Dwayne Bradley, you're the station manager. Can you talk about what you've pieced together at this point?
Well, we've had the Houston Police Department out. They were there within 20 minutes. And, of course, they conducted an initial investigation, and they were unable to turn up any slug or fragments from whatever round was fired into the building. They're in the middle of conducting an investigation still, of course. Around daylight, our chief engineer was out looking around the edge of the property and out where John had pointed to where he had seen the shot fired from the vehicle moving by. Steve Brightwell, our chief engineer, found a shell casing, so we called HPD back out to the scene, didn't touch the
Wait a
evidence.
Second. And Dwayne, you said, so the police didn't find the shell casing, but you did. When it got light up.
Right, yeah. KPFT chief engineer Steve Brightwell found it. We called the police back out, and they took it into evidence, and we've been able to find out that this is a 39-millimeter round that's commonly used in AK-47 assault rifles. So this has kind of ramped up the fear factor, if you will. It's certainly not somebody just driving by in the middle of the night with a BB gun.
So what's your sense of what happened? And did John Orr, who was at the door, Mary's co-producer on the Zydeco show, see any car, see any person?
John noticed that there was a slow-moving vehicle that had gone by earlier. And as he was letting these two folks into the building, about 12 feet away from the control room window where the front door was, he noticed this car going by, and he remarked to me later that it was moving slower than you would go through a school zone. He estimated about 15 miles an hour, maybe. And when it got to the eastern edge of our property is when this shot rang out. The two folks at the door thought it was a backfire, but John knew that it was a gunshot. And so he pulled them into the building real quick and got them behind one of the outer walls as Mary was crawling from the control room into the on-air studio.
Dwayne, do you think this could be politically motivated?
Well, certainly we can't say it's not. There's nothing that's been found yet in terms of who may have done this. KPFT has been, as you pointed out, at a point of controversy in Houston since day one, 37 and a half years ago. There were no overt threats to the station. We've received no email or voicemail or letters or anything. No one's claimed responsibility for it, but we do on Sunday evenings prior to Mary's Zydeco Pasolet show at midnight, from about 6 o'clock till midnight, we have some relatively, you know, controversial programming, Afrocentric programming that can sometimes be quite heated. And certainly we know from past experience that the KPFT has been threatened and indeed attacked.
I want to play a longer clip of what happened in October 12, 1970, the second time the transmitter of KPFT was blown up. The clip also includes commentary from KPFT founder Larry Lay.
11 o'clock Central Time last night, Arlo Guthrie was on record singing Alice's Restaurant. Just as he reached the part where he was shouting, "Kill, kill the Army psychiatrist," our transmitter got killed, blown up by what now appears to be 15 sticks of dynamite.
This is KPFT in Houston, Pacifica Radio. Now, one of my favorite songs, Alice's Restaurant by Arlo Guthrie.
They got a building down in New York City called Whitehall Street where you walk in, you get injected, inspected, detected, infected, neglected, and selected. I went in there one morning to have my physical examination. I got good and drunk the night before. I wanted to be the All-American. I wanted to feel like the All-American kid. I walked in, I was hung down, brung down, swung down, hung up. I walked in and sat down and gave me a piece of paper, said, "Kid, see the psychiatrist, room 604. I walked up there, I said, "Shrink, I want to kill."
Okay, how did you determine or how did anybody determine that's what it was?
That's the estimate made by the Houston Arson Squad, which worked the case today with the Harris County Sheriff's Department, the Bomb Squad, and the FBI, which dropped out of this case this afternoon for lack of jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
Curiously enough, the FCC says that we're probably the first radio station in the country to be dynamited off the air, and there's no federal law that covers such a thing.
I see. I thought it was a federal law to interfere.
We all assumed that it was, yeah. But they checked the books today and found out that it wasn't.
I see.
I assume one will now be written.
I understand there were no injuries in the explosion. Is
no,
that right?
But it was close. Sam Diaz, the volunteer who makes the required daily logging of the meters out of the transmitter, is very punctual. He shows up every night at 11 o'clock. Last night he was 20 minutes late, fortunately for him. Found the smoking rubble of the transmitter, which is located 20 miles south of downtown Houston where the studios are. If he'd been on time, he might have gone up with it. The
right.
Dynamite, or whatever it was very professionally planted, because while it smashed our transmitter and it shacked the smithereens, two nearby shacks and their related transmitters escaped unscathed, as did the transmission tower itself. This morning, a local construction company donated planning, materials, and labor to build a highly secure underground bomb-proof bunker to put the next transmitter in.
And that was an excerpt of the radio broadcast just after the station's transmitter was blown up, dynamite strapped to the base of the transmitter. This was October 1970. Dwayne Bradley, Larry Lee talked about, that was the KPFT general manager then, the FBI saying they wouldn't be involved. Is the FBI, why weren't they involved then, and will they be involved in this investigation today?
It's strange to hear that historic record and know that though we are a federally licensed facility, that the FBI didn't get involved at that point because they didn't believe they had any cause to or any legal standing to. I've been in touch with our attorneys in Washington, D.C., and we're working through the Enforcement Bureau at the FCC. We spoke with them yesterday to have the folks in Washington approach the FBI about getting involved here in Houston. There are no staff members on the Houston FBI office who, I'm told, have the expertise to deal with the kind of investigation that would be needed to really get to the bottom of what happened here. So we're kind of pushing on them a little bit through our attorney in Washington.
You're holding a news conference today?
Yes, we'll be holding a news conference outside the station studio window this afternoon at 1 p.m., and we'll be visiting with our city council member, Ada Edwards, who represents the district that KPFT is located in. Our congressional representative, Sheila Jackson Lee, is out of the country, but will be sending a statement that I'll be reading on her behalf.
And Mary Thomas, will you also be speaking?
I'll do my best.
Is this going to change how you do your Zydeco program now?
A little, yes.
Do you feel safe?
Oh, I'm okay. Yeah, I'm okay. Yes.
And Dwayne, all of the producers that do their programs around the clock, how will they now, as this investigation goes on, be protected? You're in the Montrose section of Houston, not a place where there are a lot of drive-by shootings.
Well, it's a bohemian section near downtown Houston, and it's not completely unusual that there would be the sound of a weapon fired, though it is rather rare. And we definitely are taking all of our volunteer and paid staff producers' safety at the highest level of concern. And we're looking at all of our different options right now as to whether or not we ought to just brick over that whole front of the building or put up steel plating, or just replace the bulletproof glass with something a bit more stout.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, Dwayne Bradley, station manager of Pacifica Station, KPFT, and Mary Thomas, host of the Zydeco program on KPFT. She narrowly missed the bullet that shot through the what they thought was bulletproof glass in the front of the station. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, Naomi Klein, stay with us.
Perhaps I am a miscreation. No one knows the truth. There is no future here. And you're the teacher, speaks to my insomnia. Laughs at all I had to fear. Laughs at all I had to fear. You always play the man.
Sung for WBAI in New York. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The State Department is coming under criticism this week for refusing to allow a prominent South African social scientist to enter the country. Adam Habib was scheduled to speak at the annual meeting of the American Sociological Association in New York this past weekend, but the government refused to give him a visa. Ironically, the theme of this year's sociology conference was, Is Another World Possible? At the conference, the ASA planned a series of sessions to assess the potential for progressive social change both in the U.S. and in the world, and to invite a serious discussion of economic globalization and its consequences. One of the most highly anticipated sessions was to feature Jeffrey Sachs, an internationally known economist and a former special advisor to U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan, versus Naomi Klein, the Canadian journalist and author. But shortly before the ASA conference opened, Sachs pulled out. Unclear if it was related to the fact that Naomi Klein takes him on in her forthcoming book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. The theme of her talk was Lost Worlds. This is Naomi Klein.
As we think about reaching this other possible world, I want to be very clear that I don't believe the problem is a lack of ideas. I think we're swimming in ideas. Universal health care, living wages, cooperatives, participatory democracy, public services that are accountable to the people who use them, food, medicine, and shelter as a human right. These aren't new ideas. They're enshrined in the UN Charter. And I think most of us still believe in them. I don't think our problem is money, lack of resources to act on these basic ideas. Now, at the risk of being accused of economic populism, I would just point out that in this city, the employees of Goldman Sachs received more than $16 billion in Christmas bonuses last year, and ExxonMobil earned $40 billion in annual profits, a world record. It seems to me that there's clearly enough money sloshing around to pay for our modest dreams. We can tax the polluters and the casino capitalists to pay for alternative energy development and a global social safety net. We don't lack ideas. Neither are we short on cash. And unlike Jeffrey Sachs, I actually don't believe that what is lacking is political will at the highest levels, cooperation between world leaders. I don't think that if we could just present our elites with the right graphs and PowerPoint presentations, no offense, that we would finally convince them to make poverty history. I don't believe that. I don't believe we could do it even if that PowerPoint presentation was being delivered by Angelina Jolie, wearing a product red TM Gap tank top and carrying a product red cell phone. Even if she had a product red iPhone, I still don't think they would listen. That's because elites don't make justice because we ask them to nicely and appealingly. They do it when the alternative to justice is worse. And that is what happened all those years ago when the income gap began to close. That was the motivation behind the New Deal and the Marshall Plan. Communism spreading around the world, that was the fear. Capitalism needed to embellish itself. It needed to soften its edges. It was in a competition. So ideas aren't the problem, and money's not the problem, and I don't think political will is ever the problem. The real problem, I want to argue today, is confidence. Our confidence. The confidence of people who gather at events like this under the banner of building another world, a kinder, more sustainable world. I think we lack the strength of our convictions, the guts to back up our ideas with enough muscle to scare our elites. We are missing movement power. That's what we're missing. The best lacked all convictions, Yeats wrote, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Think about it. Do you want to tackle climate change as much as Dick Cheney wants Kazakhstan's oil? Do you? Do you want universal health care as much as Paris Hilton wants to be the next new face of Estee Lauder? If not, why not? What is wrong with us? Where is our passionate intensity? What is at the root of our crisis of confidence? What drains us of our conviction at crucial moments when we are tested? At the root, I think it's the notion that we have accepted, which is that our ideas have already been tried and found wanting. Part of what keeps us from building the alternatives that we deserve and long for and that the world needs so desperately, like a healthcare system that doesn't sicken us when we see it portrayed on film. Like the ability to rebuild New Orleans without treating a massive human tragedy like an opportunity for rapid profit-making for politically connected contractors. The right to have bridges that don't collapse and subways that don't flood when it rains. I think that what lies at the root of that lack of confidence is that we're told over and over again that progressive ideas have already been tried and failed. We hear it so much that we've accepted it. So our alternatives are posed tentatively, almost apologetically. Is another world possible, we ask. This idea of our intellectual and ideological failure is the dominant narrative of our time. It's embedded in all the catchphrases that we've been referring to. There is no alternative, said Thatcher. History has ended, said Fukuyama. The Washington consensus. The thinking has already been done. The consensus is there. Now, the premise of all these proclamations was that capitalism, extreme capitalism, was conquering every corner of the globe because all other ideas had proven themselves disastrous. The only thing worse than capitalism, we were told, was the alternative. Now, it's worth remembering when these pronouncements were being made that what was failing was not Scandinavian social democracy, which was thriving, or Canadian-style welfare state, which has produced the highest standard of living by UN measures in the world, or at least it did before my government started embracing some of these ideas. It wasn't the so-called Asian miracle that had been discredited, which in the 80s and 90s built the Asian tiger economies in South Korea and Malaysia using a combination of trade protections to nurture and develop national industry, even when that meant keeping American products out and preventing foreign ownership, as well as maintaining government control over key assets like water and electricity. These policies did not create explosive growth concentrated at the very top as we see today, but record levels of poverty and a rapidly expanding middle class. That is what has been attacked in these past 30 years. What was failing and collapsing when history was declared over was something very specific. In 1989, when Francis Fukuyama made that famous declaration, and when the Washington Consensus was declared, also in 1989, what was collapsing was centralized state communism, authoritarian, anti-democratic, repressive. Something very specific was collapsing. And it was a moment of tremendous flux, and it was in that moment of flux and disorientation that several very savvy people, many of them in this country, seized on that moment to declare victory not only against communism, but against all ideas but their own. Now, this was the Fukuyama chutzpah, when he actually said, and it seems so strange to read it now in his famous 1989 speech, that the significance of that moment was not that we were reaching an end of ideology, as some were suggesting, or a convergence between capitalism and socialism, as Gorbachev was suggesting. It was that ideology had ended, but that history as such had ended. He argued that deregulated markets in the economic sphere, combined with liberal democracy in the political sphere, represented the end point of mankind's ideological evolution and the final form of human government. Now, what was interesting and never quite stated in this formulation was that you basically had two streams. You had democracy, which you could use to vote for your leaders, and then you had a single economic model. Now, the catch was that you couldn't use your vote, you couldn't use your democracy to reshape your economy because all of the economic decisions had already been decided. It was the final endpoint of ideological evolution. So you could have democracy, but you couldn't use it to change the basics of life. You couldn't use it to change the economy. This moment was held up as a celebration of victory for democracy, but that idea that democracy cannot affect the economy is and remains the single most anti-democratic idea of our time. Now, I was drawn to the slogan that was chosen for this year's ASA gathering, because I think, as many of you know and have read in the program, it comes from the World Social Forum. And I was at the first World Social Forum 6.5 years ago, more than 6.5 years ago, in January 2001 in Porto Alegre, Brazil. I was one of only a handful of North Americans who attended. And we gathered under that same slogan. But I think it's significant and interesting that it wasn't posed as a question back then. There was a proud exclamation mark at the end of the sentence. Another world is possible. I wrote a feature article for The Nation when I came back from Brazil, trying to explain to readers in the U.S. It wasn't covered very heavily in the international press. What it felt like to be there with 10,000 other people, and a lot of people were saying that they felt like we were making history. And what I wrote was that what it really felt like was the end of the end of history. That's what it felt like to be in that room. It was this powerful gust of wind that you could suddenly breathe more deeply. You were free to imagine. Our minds were unleashed. And it wasn't just Porto Alegre, because Porto Alegre was the culmination of these types of spontaneous uprisings that were happening around the world whenever world leaders were gathering to advance the so-called Washington Consensus, whether it was in Seattle at the WTO meeting in 1999, whether it was the IMF World Bank meetings a few years later in Washington, then in Genoa during the G8, and of course the Zapatistas and the MST in Brazil were at the forefront. And the theme in Porto Alegre was democracy. It was about redefining democracy to include the economy, deep democracy, participatory democracy. And it was a challenge to this idea that these two streams could not intersect. The right to land as a form of democracy, the right to biodiversity, to independent media. But what was most extraordinary about Porto Alegre was that, you know, certainly there were some politicians there were some big NGOs there, but the people who were at the podiums, who were shaping the discussion, were the people who were the casualties of this economic model, who were themselves discarded, made landless, forced to occupy pieces of land, chop down fences, and plant food, and make decisions democratically. So, you know, Jeffrey Sachs talks about these model villages that he's building in Africa, and many of them are making tremendous progress. But I can't help thinking back to these field trips that we made in Porto Alegre to MST villages, where it was the people themselves, the landless people themselves, who were showing us their own model villages and were asking for our solidarity. And I think as sociologists, you understand this key distinction, that it was the actors, who were the protagonists of their history. And that was what was historic. It was breaking the charity model in a very real way. Now, I look at where we are now, 6.5 years later, and it does feel that we have moved backwards in many areas. Talk of fixing the world has become an astonishingly elite affair. Davos. And now, Porto Alegre was a rebellion against the Davos summit every year in January. This was the anti-Davos. Davos has been re-legitimized. And now solving the world's problems appears to be a matter between CEOs and super celebrities. And the idea that we don't need to challenge these mass disparities, what we need is sort of noblesse oblige on a mass scale. That is very different than what we were talking about in Porto Alegre those years ago. Now, we know what closed that window of possibility, that freedom that opened up in 2001, and it was September 11th in this country. And the window didn't close everywhere, but it did close, at least temporarily, in North America, that sense of possibility, that putting these issues and the people affected by these policies at the center of the political debate. Now, the shock of those attacks, I think we can see with some hindsight, was harnessed by leaders in this country and their allies around the world to abruptly end the discussion of global justice that was exploding around the world. There was a door that had opened, and it was suddenly slammed shut. We heard that phrase again and again, 9/11 changes everything. And one of the first things we were told that it had changed was that trade, privatization, labor rights, all the things we were fighting for just so recently, no longer mattered. It was year zero, wipe the slate clean. And it was another one of these rebooting history moments. History was apparently starting all over again from scratch, and nothing we knew before mattered. It was all relegated to pre-9/11 thinking. Now, the Bush administration justified this by saying that all that mattered was security and the war on terror. And in Canada, we were told that by the U.S. ambassador that security trumps trade. That became the new slogan. That before 9/11, it was economic priorities that drove the U.S. administration. But post 9/11, the only thing that mattered was security. So talk of economic justice, corporate greed, the loss of the public sphere. The talk of Porto Alegre was suddenly retro. So 2001. Now, the irony that we can now see is that while denying the importance of this economic project, the Bush administration used the dislocation of 9/11 to pursue the very same pre-9/11 radical capitalist project, now with a furious vengeance under the cover of war and natural disasters. So forget negotiating trade deals at the World Trade Organization. When the U.S. invaded Iraq, Bush sent in Paul Bremer to seize new markets on the battlefields of his preemptive war. He didn't have to negotiate with anyone. He just rewrote the country's entire economic architecture in one swoop. But of course, if you said that the war had anything to do with economics, you were dismissed as naive. It was, of course, about security, about liberating Iraqis from Saddam.
Journalist Naomi Klein will be back with her speech in a minute.
Steel.
You be rubber.
You be am rubber. You be thief.
You
be rogue. You be steel.
You
be rubber. You be am rubber. I not be thief.
All right, look.
You be thief.
I not be rogue.
You be rogue.
I not they steal.
You be steal.
I not be robber.
You be robber.
Authority Stealing by Fela here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Is returned to journalist Naomi Klein.
Meanwhile, at home, the administration quickly moved to exploit the shock that gripped the nation to push through a radical vision of hollow government in which everything from waging wars to reconstructing from those wars to disaster response became an entirely for-profit venture. This was a bold evolution of market logic. Rather than the 90s approach of selling off existing public companies like water and electricity, the Bush team was creating a whole new framework for its actions. That framework was and is the War on Terror, which was built to be private, privately managed from the start. The Bush administration played the role of a kind of a venture capitalist for the startup security companies, and they created an economic boom on par with the dot-com boom of the 1990s. But we didn't talk about it because we were too busy talking about security. Now, this feat required a kind of two-stage process, which was using 9/11, of course, to radically increase the surveillance and security powers of the state, concentrated in the executive branch, but at the same time to take those powers and outsource them to a web of private companies, whether Blackwater, Boeing, AT&T, Halliburton, Bechtel, the Carlyle Group. Now, in the 80s, the goal of privatization and in the 90s was devouring the appendages of the state. But what was happening now is it was the core that was being devoured, because what is more central to the very definition of a state, of a government, than security and disaster response? Now, this is one of the great ironies of the war on terror, is that it proved such an effective weapon to furthering the corporate agenda precisely because it denied that it has, and continues to deny that it has a corporate agenda at all. Now, it had another benefit, too, which was the ability to paint anyone who opposed this system as aligned with potential terrorists and so on. So our movement, which was already facing extreme repression before 9/11, was put on notice as traitorous. Looking back, it's clear that the shock, the disorientation caused by the attacks, was used to reassert this economic agenda, to reassert that consensus that never really was. The window that was opened at the end of the 90s in the movement known as the anti-globalization movement, but which was always a pro-democracy movement, was slammed shut, at least in North America. And it was terror that slammed it shut. The alternative started to disappear. Now, I want to use the rest of my time just to say that this was not the first time. That this, if we look back at the past 35 years, we see this slamming of the door on alternatives just as they are emerging, repeating again and again. Many of you were here for the opening address from Ricardo Lagos, the former president of Chile, who talked about another September 11th, which was another one of those moments, a far more significant one, when a very important democratic alternative, the real third way, not Tony Blair's third way, but the real third way between totalitarian communism and extreme capitalism was being forged in Chile. And that was the great threat. And we know that now through all the declassified documents. There's a really revealing one, a correspondence between Henry Kissinger and Nixon, in which Kissinger says very bluntly that the problem with Allende's election is not what they were saying publicly, which was that he was aligned with the Soviets, that he was only pretending to be democratic, but that he was really going to impose a totalitarian system in Chile. That was the spin at the time. What he actually wrote was, the example of a successful elected Marxist government in Chile would surely have an impact on, and even precedent value for, other parts of the world. The imitative spread of similar phenomena elsewhere would in turn significantly affect the world balance and our own position in it. So that alternative, that other world, had to be blasted out of the way, and extreme violence was used in order to accomplish that. Now, this kind of preemptive attack on our democratic alternatives, the persistent dream of a third way, of a real third way, has come up again and again. And this is what I discuss at length in the book, but I want to mention a couple of examples, unless I'm totally out of time, okay? Examples of moments where there was a similar sense of effervescent possibility, of being able to breathe more and dream more fully. One of them was in Poland in 1989. June 4th was the day of the historic elections in Poland that elected Solidarity as the new government. They hadn't had elections there in decades. And this was the event that really set off the domino, what's now referred to as the domino effect in Eastern Bloc countries, and ultimately resulting in the breaking apart of the Soviet Union. But it's worth remembering what it actually looked like in June of 1989. In Poland, people didn't think that history was over because they had just elected Solidarity as their government. They thought that history was just beginning, and that they were finally going to be able to implement what the movement, which was a labor movement, had always seen as the third way, the third way not taken. Now, Solidarity's vision was not a rejection of socialism. They said that they were calling for real socialism, as socialists often do. And it was a rejection of the Communist Party. They were everything that the party was not, dispersed where it was centralized, democratic where it was authoritarian. participatory where it was bureaucratic. And Solidarity had 10 million members, which gave them the power to completely shut down the state. So when people went to the polls and elected a Solidarity government, what were they voting for? What did they think they were voting for? Did they think that they were voting to become a free market economy on the model that Francis Fukuyama was talking about? No, they didn't. They thought they were voting for the Labor Party that they had helped to build. And I just want to read you a short passage from Solidarity's economic program, which was passed democratically in 1981. They said the socialized enterprise should be the basic organizational unit in the economy. It should be controlled by the workers' councils representing the collective and should be operated cooperatively run by a director appointed through competition recalled by the council, workers' cooperatives. So the idea was to get the party out of control of the economy, to decentralize it and have the people who were doing the work actually control their workplaces. And they believed that they could make them more sustainable. Now, did they get the chance to try that, to act on that vision of workers, a worker cooperative economy as the centerpiece of the economy, to have democratic elections, but still have socialism? Did they get that chance when they voted for Solidarity? No, they didn't. What they got was an inherited debt, and they were told that the only way that they would get any relief from that debt and any aid is if they followed a very radical shock therapy program. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that the person who prescribed that shock therapy program was Jeffrey Sachs. I say that because I really had hope that we could debate these different worlds, because there are differences. There are real differences that we must not smooth over. Now, in 2006, 40% of young workers in Poland were unemployed, 40%. Last year. That's twice the EU average. And Poland is often held up as a great success story of transition. In 1989, 15% of Poland's population was living below the poverty line. In 2003, 59% of Poles had fallen below the line. That's that opening of that gap. That's what these economic policies do. And then we can say, we're very, very worried about the people at the bottom. Let's bring them up. But let's be clear about what we're talking about. These jarring levels of inequality and economic exclusion are now feeding a resurgence of chauvinism, racism, anti-Semitism, misogyny, rampant homophobia in Poland. And I think we can see, actually, that it's inevitable that this would be the case, because they tried communism, they tried capitalism, they tried democratic socialism, but they got shock therapy instead. After you've tried all that, there really isn't a whole lot left but fascism. It's dangerous to suppress democratic alternatives when people invest their dreams in them. It's risky business. Another one of these powerful dreams was Tiananmen Square. And it's a very sad fluke of history that on the same day that Solidarity won those historic elections and that dream was betrayed, what they voted for was betrayed, tanks rolled in Tiananmen Square, and that was the day of the massacre. June 4th, 1989. It was another bloody end to a moment of effervescent possibility. Now, the way those protests were always reported on in the West was that students in Beijing just wanted to live like in the United States, and they put a goddess to democracy that looked a lot like the Statue of Liberty. So it was reported on CNN as just kind of pro-American-style democracy protests. But in recent years, an alternative analysis of those events have emerged. And what we're starting to hear from what's being called China's New Left and people like Wang Hui, who's a wonderful academic, and is that this was a vast oversimplification of what was driving the pro-democracy movement in 1989 in China. What was driving it was that the government of Deng Xiaoping was radically restructuring the economy along the lines that had been prescribed by Milton Friedman, economic shock therapy. And people were seeing their quality of life devalued. Workers were losing their rights, and they were taking to the streets and demanding democratic control over the economic transition. So democracy wasn't an abstract idea. It wasn't just we want to vote. It was we want to control this transition. We want to have a say in it. It was a direct challenge to the Fukuyama formulation, which, by the way, was made that same year. The idea that you could that you would have these two streams and that they wouldn't intersect. I just want to read one other thing, which is another one of these paths not taken. Because we know how that one ended in Tiananmen Square. That dream was crushed. Another historic moment of possibility when we look back on our recent history was 1994, when the ANC government won landslide elections in South Africa. That was a victory for people power. That was one of the most hopeful days that I can remember. I think we should remember what South Africans thought they were voting for in those historic elections. You know, it was just portrayed as something very simple. It was an end to apartheid. But what did an end to apartheid mean to South Africans? And we can get an answer from that, actually from Nelson Mandela, who wrote a little note 2 weeks before he left. He was released from prison. And he wrote this note because there was a growing concern that he'd been in prison so long that he had forgotten the promise of liberation, which was not just to have elections, but to change the economy of the country and redistribute the wealth. And Mandela was under so much pressure that he had to release this very short statement just to clarify this point. And what he said was, "The nationalization of the mines, banks, and monopoly industry is the policy of the ANC. And the change or modification of our views in this regard is inconceivable. In our situation, state control of certain sectors of the economy is unavoidable." And this was a reiteration of South Africa's Freedom Charter, which is the platform of the ANC, which calls for the national wealth of South Africa, the heritage of the country, to be restored for the people, the mineral wealth, and so on. Now, I say this because This was one of those worlds that wasn't chosen, one of those paths that wasn't chosen. And I've spent the past 4 years pulling these stolen and betrayed alternatives out of the dustbin of our recent history because I think it matters. I think it matters that we had ideas all along, that there were always alternatives to the free market. And we need to retell our own history and understand that history. And we have to have all the shocks and all the loss of lives in that story. Because history didn't end. There were alternatives. They were chosen, and then they were stolen. They were stolen by military coups. They were stolen by massacres. They were stolen by trickery, by deception. They were stolen by terror. We who say we believe in this other world need to know that we are not losers. We did not lose the battle of ideas. We were not outsmarted, and we were not out-argued. We lost because we were crushed. Sometimes we were crushed by army tanks, and sometimes we were crushed by think tanks. And by think tanks, I mean the people who are paid to think by the makers of tanks. Now, most effective we have seen is when the army tanks and the think tanks team up. The quest to impose a single world market has casualties now in the millions, from Chile then to Iraq today. These blueprints for another world were crushed and disappeared because they are popular and because, when tried, they work. They're popular because they have the power to give millions of people lives of dignity, with the basics guaranteed. They are dangerous because they put real limits on the rich, who respond accordingly. Understanding this history, understanding that we never lost the battle of ideas, that we only lost a series of dirty wars, is key to building the confidence that we lack, to igniting the passionate intensity that we need.
Naomi Klein, author of the forthcoming book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. You can get a copy at our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.